All right, welcome everybody. Thank you so much for joining us today. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to our training. It is the incremental sampling methodology update. We are doing our expert panel today. So we are here to respond to questions. If you are interested, we encourage you to visit the guidance document. It is at ism-2.itrcweb.org, and we will put that in the chat here in a moment. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate on technical teams, which produce tools and resources and training courses. We encourage you to visit itrcweb.org to learn more about joining our organization. Additionally, the full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. Here in slide four, I am welcoming our expert trainers that have joined us today. We are being reunited after 1 year when they hosted session one and session two of the incremental sampling methodology training courses, which are archived, the full slide deck, as well as the full audio and video recording of those sessions from March of 2021 are still available on Cluin. And today we're coming together to reintroduce some concepts and answer questions with this expert panel. So I am welcoming everybody today. And I think to get us started, let's define some of the terms that we are going to hear and recap ISM. So I'm going to ask Jason, do you want to give us a quick overview of concepts covered in module zero of session one?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So assuming everyone has reviewed that module one, just kind of quickly go over some of the key terms we'll be using. I mean, ISM itself is a highly structured, systematic composite sample. It's designed to capture the average concentrations across a given volume of soil. And we call that volume of soil the decision unit. Some practitioners use the term sampling unit if multiple ISM samples will be used to make a single decision. But for the purposes just of this discussion, we'll just kind of stick to the one-to-one relationship between a decision unit DU and the ISM sample. The term EU is used sometimes as an exposure unit. That's a specific kind of decision unit that is aimed at capturing a concentration associated with a specific exposure, whether it be ecological or human health. Increments are the small soil increments. I'm not sure what else. It's usually at looking at 10 or 30 grams of soil, a teaspoon or a tablespoon, depending on how many increments you're collecting. Those are intended to represent the volume of soil in your decision unit. And of course, ISM has a huge focus on the use of replicates, whether it be triplicates or more replicates, in order to really understand how well your number of increments captures the heterogeneity of the decision unit in question. So given kind of the broad nature of these terms, I just kind of want to talk about the importance of planning, making sure all stakeholders are brought in at the beginning. Everyone understands the decision units, why they're selected, the increments, how it is that you justify or quantify that the number of increments is appropriate for the decisions you're making. So all these are really important parts of the planning. And of course, hand in hand with that is understanding what your conceptual site model is and understanding what are the volumes you're interested in, what are the kind of questions you're trying to answer, and how are you going to use the data? Whether you're going to use, what sort of statistics are you going to use with your replicates? How exactly are all those pieces going to fit together? And if you use an ISM to develop your conceptual site model, that's kind of a different question altogether, but also a great tool for it. And then I guess I'll close on how do you set up your decision unit? I mean, this is probably the most interesting and challenging part of incremental sampling is how do you set up your decision unit? I mean, decision units can be as small as a storm drain inlet. They can be as large as an agricultural field of 2,000 acres. We've seen these sorts of applications across the US and internationally with large and small decision units. And how do you set it up? What question are you trying to answer? And that's really probably the basic starting off point for how do you set up your decision unit? And that's my recap.
That's great. Thank you. I think it's important to run through our terminology that we're going to hear. So I mentioned that we last did this in March of 2021. And we know the world has changed, but I guess has anything in the ISM world changed? And Todd, I think I'll start picking on you first.
Sure. So over the last year, I would say that from an ISM perspective, not really much has changed. The concepts, the methodologies, the practices is still virtually the same as what's in the guidance document. I think some of the things that have changed include a better understanding of ISM from consultants and regulators. We've seen that it's being used at more complex or more interesting sites. So that's a good thing. I still think there are some misconceptions about the data and the use of data. And that's probably a thing that we still are trying to affect a change on. For example, there's a lot of questions about will ISM dilute the sample, or will it miss an area of higher concentration? And as Jason indicated, an ISM is a statistical representation of the expected concentration within a decision unit, whatever that decision unit is. So it's not designed to give you the absolute maximum. It's designed to tell you what you could expect if you were looking at that decision unit, what is most probable concentration. So if you're concerned about an area that might have elevated concentrations, maybe consider that its own separate decision unit. So that it comes back to how are you planning your decision units? How are you planning your investigation? What is your site conceptual model? I think the other thing is that we really are trying to enact a change on involvement and early involvement by stakeholders and by the regulatory agencies. Within the ISM world, it's critical that we get the end user, the people that are going to use the data, rely on the data, make the decisions about the data, be involved in that planning process, that they're comfortable with the size of the decision unit or what the decision unit is supposed to represent. How are the data being collected? What are those statistical parameters that you're trying to achieve? Is it a 95% UCL? Is there a certain RPD that you're trying to achieve with the data? So getting all of that involved or getting all of that worked out in the very beginning certainly helps you develop a more robust program that will fit the needs of the end users, which is really what you ought to be focused on in the beginning. So that being said, I'll ask Mark, who's on the laboratory side of things, whether or not he's seen any changes over the last year with respect to ISM. Mark?
Well, probably one of the bigger changes is just an uptick in the frequency of ISM work. We're seeing it come up more frequently from our clients, and the breadth of sites that it's being applied to. Jason already alluded to, agricultural fields. It historically has been used on a number of DOD facilities. We're seeing it applied to a broader range of analytes. For example, there are more requests for PFAS. It's like PFAS touches all sorts of things, and it has definitely touched the ISM world. It brings its own special constraints with it. We're also seeing kind of a coalescing of the combination of ISM processing options, but we can talk more about that in detail later.
How about Karen from the regulatory side? Any updates since March?
Sorry, I had to get unmuted there. The only thing that I've noticed is that it's being used a lot more. So I've seen a number of sites where we've had ISM used for risk assessment. And I do want to let our viewers know that ISM is appropriate for risk assessment. As you heard, it's an estimate of the average concentration, but what we use in risk assessment is an average concentration. With discrete samples, we use a 95% upper confidence limit of the mean concentration. And that's what we're using here also. We're taking a 95% UCL from our three replicates, or if you have more replicates, and using that for our risk assessment. I will also add that in terms of the planning, there's a lot of good information within section 3.1 of our ISM guidance document. So you can look there for help with planning, and there's some scenario examples to help you along with the planning aspects and deciding on how to make your GUs and the number of increments and replicates, et cetera. So I'll pass it back to you, Nicole. Thank you.
Great, thanks. And I think just because you just talked about the 95% UCL, we did have an audience question. So I am going to put this in here and ask Kaylee to come off of mute. And the question was, can the maximum replicate be used to represent a conservative estimate of the mean, or should it always be the 95% UCL of the mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the short answer is, for ISM designs, that's not going to be an appropriate substitution. And the reason for that is because of the sample size that's going to be typical in ISM designs. So normally, if you have, say you collected 15 samples and discrete samples, and you calculate a UCL, and that UCL is higher than the maximum concentration, that's not really a reasonable estimate of the central tendency. So that's why it's appropriate to substitute the maximum concentration as a conservative estimate in that case. But if you take three ISM samples, it would be totally reasonable to have the UCL exceed all three of those samples. Depending on the variation, that might be a reasonable conservative estimate of central tendency. So a lot of it depends on the sample size, but for most designs, it's not really appropriate to substitute the maximum concentration.
Great. Thanks, Haley. That was great. All right. Well, let's go back. A couple of our speakers have mentioned planning for ISM. So when planning for ISM, what do you need to do to appropriate plan for the intended use of the data? Who do you need to include in the planning process? And as I call on Todd to come off of mute to answer the question, I will ask the participants to go ahead and use the chat box and let us know who you usually include in the planning process.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from the audience is to what they think as well. I mean, from a perspective of who do you want to include and what do you need to do? I always try to start, and I'll quote a good friend of mine, always start with the end in mind. Who is going to be the end user of the data? Who is going to have to rely on the data, and what questions are you trying to answer? So once you understand what questions you're trying to answer and who needs to have that understanding, then you can look back and really ask what the questions are, or what data you need to collect to answer the questions. So when you follow that road and work backwards, what you're looking at really is starting to develop your planning process using the systematic planning process that we describe in section 3.1 of the document, and going through a very detailed, organized planning process to look at, you know, a robust site conceptual model. What does that look like? What data gaps do you have, and what additional questions do you need to answer based on those data gaps? Establishing and having clear objectives of your investigation will make sure that you are collecting the appropriate data to answer the questions that you've set aside. Section 9 of the document describes very well kind of the stakeholder and the regulatory involvement and why it's critical to get them involved early in the process. So, you know, if you're collecting data, but you're not involving the end users, how do you know that that data is going to answer the questions that they have? Or if the data is going to be of an appropriate quality, maybe you go out and collect data and you don't pay attention to the quality of the data. It might be rejected at the very end of the day, and then you basically starting over. So involving your stakeholders and your end users early in the process is really critical. The outcome of good systematic planning is a well thought out sampling plan with well thought out and well laid out decision units whose dimensions and locations will inform the end users about the potential for impacts. And it will help support the investigation questions that you have. So, Nicole?
Thanks, Todd. Great. Well, I wanted to say thanks to those that typed in who they include, and a lot of the comments were state and federal regulators, risk assessors, field planning staff, data managers, project manager, and then the risk assessor for all parties involved. So, great coverage and appreciate it. We do have a fair number of questions coming in, so I am going to start just teeing up some of these for the experts. And Jason, we had a question about hotspots here. So would you agree that ISM sampling doesn't inform about the presence of a hotspot?
So this is, as Todd mentioned earlier, I think this is the number one concern about using ISM. The lack of ability to identify variability of concentrations within an area. And I think I want to answer this two different ways. One is that if you think a lot of the origins of ISM are centered around mining and actually looking for trace elements. So the concept being that if you actually want to find a hotspot, or an elevated concentration, that ISM is the best way to do it. And it's the best way to do it because it provides coverage. And this concept of dilution, I mean, the only thing I can say is, if you do this enough, you'll see that, in fact, you'll find stuff that otherwise you would have missed. So if you think about a hotspot being maybe 100 or 1,000 times the concentration of the rest of it, and I don't really know what the definition of a hotspot is. A lot of people have different definitions. But even if it's 100 times, all you need is one or two increments to be inside of that area of elevated concentration, and it will have an impact on your result. And, you know, once you start seeing different ISM pieces together, maybe one will stick out as different, and then you can go in there and you can maybe cut it in four and then start to see, are there patterns in that four different DUs? And sure enough, you can ultimately find your hotspot. So that's kind of half the answer, which is, that's what ISM is intended for, is to find things, not to dilute things. The second half of that, and the corollary of that, is how are you doing it right now? Because if you follow something like VSP and you plug in the hotspot volume or area that you want to find, are you in fact doing that many discrete samples? And the answer in my experience has been no, nobody collects as many discrete samples as you need to have a 95% confidence of hitting a hotspot. And so it strikes me as a question, which is, yes, ISM can find it. It might take a couple iterations, but what are you doing currently to find it? There's a false sense of confidence in collecting 10 discrete samples, and if they're all clean, you don't have a hotspot. I mean, I think just think about the coverage. Just continue to challenge yourself about the coverage. If you want to find a hotspot that's 5x5, you either have to sample in making sure you have something in 5x5, or have increments that come from that 5x5 and get full coverage. So that's my answer to that.
Nicole, I would like to just bring up the point about the VSP module for ISM. Could you go to slide 21? Oops. That was it. Yeah. Thank you. So there is VSP is visual sample plan, and there's this elevated regions model within it. And you can use this to determine, to look at rows and columns of increments. And you'll see that where their higher concentrations overlap and will give you basically a sector. So it helps you define areas of hotspots. So we do have a means of looking, specifically looking for hotspots, if you would want to use that. And that is presented within our guidance document, also within section 3.1. Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah, thanks. And both to Karen and Jason, we had another question just that mentioned hotspots. So I want to make sure that the conversation you feel covered the other question, which was, we hear of the advantages of ISM and the shortcomings of discrete sampling. Are there any disadvantages of ISM, and specifically a concern with the potential dilution of hotspots?
This is Tara, and I would say one of the key disadvantages, the pushback I get, is the field labor.
Yeah, ISM also, when it does become more costly when you're talking about deep samples, deep decision units, and you're just talking about the need for drill rigs to put 30 borings down. But I kind of always feel like, well, what's the question you're trying to answer? If you're trying to find something, are you going to have good data that might cost more, or are you going to rely on data that you don't have very high confidence in? Other than that, I don't honestly see any disadvantage to it. I've been doing it for almost 20 years now, and I feel like I've yet to run into a circumstance where I would have rather had a discrete sample. It just hasn't come up.
And there's also the cost estimator within our guidance document that one could use to compare sampling with discrete versus ISM. And you have to keep in mind the reliability of your data that you're going to get from ISM versus discrete. So that's those are other options just available to you.
Yeah, that's great. We had a question about moisture correction. So I'm going to tee up Mark here. And just the question was just, can you discuss a little bit moisture correction of soil results?
Okay. Yeah, there are basically three different options for doing moisture correction depending on how the actual ISM sample is being processed. There are some ISM processes where we're actually working with the as-received sample. So in other words, it has its normal field moisture content. So for example, if you're applying ISM to volatiles, then we collect increments in the field, put them directly into methanol. So there is no air drying step involved in that. So in that case, we also need a non-air dried field sample that is representative of the decision unit that we can then do a percent moisture analysis on and use that for moisture correction for the actual volatiles results. Another option would be that, okay, if we've selected ISM processes that involve air drying, then at the same time that we collect the subsamples for the analytical subsamples to go into sample preparation, we can also collect another subsample at that point and submit it for percent moisture analysis. Usually at that point, there's not a whole lot of moisture left. It's going to be 1, 2, 3, maybe 5% moisture at that point after we've gone through the air drying process. So it would allow for a small correction. And some data users do request that. In other cases, they say, you know what, a 2% correction is kind of what I'm expecting. Let's not bother with that. We're just going to assume that after the air drying, we're essentially at 0% moisture. So we're going to go with unmathematically corrected results at that point. So those are kind of the three different options that are in use right now.
Excellent. Let's do another audience question here. And it asked, is it necessary to have the laboratory perform a replicate analysis in addition to field sample replicates to be able to determine if variability is field related versus lab related?
Well, certainly, if you want to try to distinguish whether the variability in the final results is due to laboratory processes versus field processes, then doing some laboratory replicates would help you to make that distinction. If that distinction doesn't really help you with your end decisions, or you're not trying to shall we say, tweak the lab processes from the beginning of a project as you move through it, then that information, although for those of us who are curious, might be interesting, it might not be useful. But we have projects that go both ways. Sometimes where we do laboratory triplicates on selected samples to get some idea as to how much variability there is in the fully processed sample versus between field triplicates.
Excellent. Thanks. The question here, has there been a comparison between ISM and other sampling methodology in terms of best representation of the site conditions? Open this to anybody here.
I mean, we've done it. I don't know that we've done it enough that I can opine on what is universal, but you know, I have found actually that we've gotten higher concentrations, comparable but higher with ISM, which again goes to the, you know, we're really not missing anything argument. We are more likely to be picking stuff up that might be in very small pockets because the grab samples miss them. So, you know, we're seeing higher levels. That's what I found. I don't know if anyone else in the group has been on a project where we've looked at both.
Jason?
Yeah, I've worked on several projects that we've done both. We started with discrete sampling, then we moved to incremental sampling. And exactly what was just mentioned is usually you find more contamination, you find out where it actually is. I know there's a number of case studies or examples Roger Brewer from the Hawaii Department of Health has talked about where they have come in and done incremental sampling after discrete sampling and basically really found where the contamination was and where it wasn't. And I think, am I mistaken that our guidance also has some examples in there in the back?
You're right. Our guidance does have some examples in it. I think that the examples for the discrete versus ISM type of sampling, I think there's a little bit of that in section 2. I'm thinking of the example of looking at lead concentrations within section 2, that with the discrete versus ISM. So I think we have some, and I think that there may have been some within ISM 1 also.
You're right. So, section 2. Go ahead, Karen.
Go ahead, Tom.
Section 2 does include a discussion, and one of those is lead concentrations and the nugget effect and the soil heterogeneity. And to really get to their question about what represents site conditions more accurately, you know, what do you consider best representing it? You know, ISM by collecting more increments and analyzing that as a single sample, you're avoiding a lot of the heterogeneity of grab samples that can really impact your results falsely one direction or another, especially when you consider like metals contamination that is by far not uniformly distributed within a soil matrix.
That's great. Since we did hear the words grab sample, I'm going to jump to this question. That is, if the intent is to proof the positive in an enforcement action, can we use ISM instead of a grab sample?
Well, I don't know what the regulations state for enforcement actions, but MIMO certainly can use ISM for demonstrating that the concentrations are within a certain point of departure for contamination versus non-contamination. It is very reliable data using the ISM method.
Great. Thank you, Karen.
And a lot of it comes back to the initial discussion. How did you set up your decision units? Did you pick your decision units properly? That's critical step in ISM is doing a proper site evaluation and assigning your decision units in a proper manner.
Thanks, Tom, for that additional. Lots more questions rolling in here. Does the team have any suggestions to allow for the use of ISM sampling with the legacy background data collected using discrete?
Well, we're going to cover that a little later, but it's, you really can't compare them. That's the short answer. I think I've been in this situation semi-quantitatively. You know, if you have an ISM site data set and you're seeing something that is, you know, 10 or 50 or 100 times more than you're seeing with discrete background samples, you can probably conclude you're above background, but you couldn't do anything statistical. I wouldn't do any kind of mathematical comparison. And I mean, Haley may be able to comment more, you know, being more on the statistics end of this, but you have to be really, really careful. You just can't mix and match.
Yeah, I agree. It's really an apples to oranges comparison when you try to do that. So, you know, you could do something semi-quantitative, like looking at histograms or box plots, but you know, when you start getting into statistical tests, that's really not going to be a good idea for comparing discrete and ISM samples.
Great. Tom, we have an audience question that was very similar to one we had a conversation around, which was, do you have an example of ISM in a media that is not soil? Because our attendee commented that most of the discussion of ISM seems to be related to soil analysis. Is ISM applicable to sediment collection?
Sure, I'll speak to that. I actually have an ongoing project that we're analyzing sediment within an unnamed tributary at a site of mine. It's we're actually at the post-closure confirmation phase. The original confirmation samples in the stream were proven to be pretty confounding. And sometimes we're this and sometimes we're that. So we had a discussion with the agency on how to approach it, and they suggested we might want to consider ISM. So we, you know, again, you have to do a systematic planning and decision unit designation within the stream. You know, not all portions of the stream are the same. Field implementation and sample collection and processing discussions were critical in coming to an agreement on how we wanted to approach it. We talked a little bit earlier about the different stakeholders that you needed to bring to the table. You know, we had human health risk assessors, we had ecological risk assessors, we had groundwater professionals that were worried about groundwater contribution to sediment. We had the stream geomorphologists that were concerned about sedimentation in certain parts of the stream and not other parts of the stream. We had a couple of contributing sediment or, you know, drainage ditches that were contributing sediment into our stream. And using ISM allowed us to take all those stakeholders' concerns, come up with a broken up decision unit that addressed all their concern. And it's proven to be a pretty successful project. One of the things that Mark hit on with moisture correction, versus, you know, are you drying it or as built or as received, moisture concentration was an issue on that site. There's some in the regulatory community that think if you air dry a sample, you're changing, in our case, it was metals. So they were worried that we were going to change the metals from being in a leachable format in the stream, and we'd make them non-leachable when we were running our leaching test to determine bioavailability. So there's a number of examples throughout the document that point out that although it's primarily set up for a soil sampling regime, it's also suitable to waste piles, sediments, and a number of other media. Again, you just need to know what your endpoint is, why you're doing it, what all the contributing factors are, and set up your program appropriately.
That's great. Thanks, Tom.
Okay. We have also seen some sediment projects, some where the sediment is more or less full-time underwater. Obviously, those tend to have fairly high water content. So if air drying is appropriate to use for those samples, need to allow some extra time to evaporate that water. We've also seen it applied to, I guess, what I would call seasonal sediments, where part of the year it's underwater and part of the time it's not. So depending on when samples are collected, you can end up with a variety of moisture management techniques that are needed.
Yeah, we had about 10 or 15% solid, so it took a long time to air dry them. So you got to include that in your project schedule.
I apologize for the background noise. I'm going to tee up Tamara and Karen here. We have...
Yeah, my dogs are all worked up now.
Yeah, so we had a question about, do I have to collect ISM background? And an audience question about, is ISM appropriate for determining background concentration, for example, of naturally occurring metals?
Well, I mean, I think it could be that absolutely you can use ISM to characterize any area. The key is to make sure that you select a background area that is appropriate, that is free of known sources, or if you're looking at maybe regional conditions, is free of point sources but reflects regional inputs, and you might want to consider kind of dividing up your DUs or your SUs, and we'll go over this a little later, or maybe we should pull up that if you have 310 from the
slide 38
document.
Apologies for
figure. Yeah. So you can kind of move. Right. Can you see the background areas cobbled together off to the right? That might be a good way to do it, but pick a few zones. And so that are not necessarily contiguous, so that you do have good representation of your background conditions, and you could use that without having the intention to compare the results to site information. You could just use that to characterize prevailing conditions, certainly. Bear in mind, though, that a UCL is not an upper tolerance limit. So, I don't know, again, now we're back in the statistical realm here, but you know, when you're looking at creating a background number, you usually want to select something that is at the upper end of your background range. You don't want a measure of central tendency, because then by definition, a half or a large portion, depending on your distribution of your results, may actually be above that measure of central tendency. So I don't know of a way you could use ISM to develop a UTL. I don't know if anyone has used the data in another way. So again, it would probably be more of a semi-quantitative. You wouldn't want to develop a bright line. It's more general characterization.
Yeah, I think the issue with UTLs and ISM samples, I mean, there's a few issues. So ISM samples are representative of the average concentration, which is fundamentally contradicting of what we want to represent with the UTL. So that's one reason. Another reason is that to estimate a percentile, you need an upper percentile, you need a very large number of samples. You know, even most discrete designs are sometimes inadequate in the number of samples to estimate a UTL. So yeah, I think in general, UTLs are not really appropriate for ISM designs. And anyway, it's really more effective to do a statistical test to compare a background population with a site population, rather than develop a bright line.
Great, thank you. I'm gonna note that we do have about 20 minutes left. We have several questions in both the chat and the Q&A pod that I do not think we will make it all the way through. So trainers, as you're waiting on questions, it would be great to take a look and see which ones we can get back to in writing. But Jason, I'm gonna put you on the spot here on a question clarifying a statement that was used in our first training. So could you elaborate on the statement from the slides in the first training and focusing on the phrase scale of observation. So the full information was ISM is a way to generate soil data that is representative of the scale of the decision, unlike discrete sampling, which generates data that is more representative of the scale of observation.
That's a great question. And when I do trainings, I think I either stumble on that a little bit and sometimes I lose folks a little bit. So it seems a little esoteric, kind of these two different ideas. And I think the best way to really just capture what we're trying to get at is it's not uncommon for us traditionally with discrete samples to make a decision on a big volume of area based on the soil that would fit inside of a Coca-Cola cap. You know, 10 or 30 grams of soil that's collected from one location. And I think that concept is that you're making a decision on one small observation, as opposed to making a decision on 50 or 75 caps that are selected from the area you're trying to make a decision on. And it's best, I think, you know, I know Hawaii Department of Health has a slide, and I've used it too with Roger, is just shows a backhoe going through a trench and an exposed face of that trench. And the question is, how do you want to make a decision on that trench? Do you want to make it by taking one teaspoon of soil from that? So that's kind of, you're just observing whatever is in that teaspoon as opposed to a sample that represents the whole area. So that's kind of the way that I distinguish those two different types of ways of looking at that. I don't know if that answers the question or not, but that's how I deal with it.
Great, that's helpful. I'm going to go back because Mark did comment that one of the changes in the last year was just seeing questions about ISM being used to address PFAS. And it was asked in our audience attendee list here, what are the special requirements for PFAS?
Well, certainly PFAS brings its own contamination control requirements, whether that's in the field or in the lab. Since there are so many PFAS chemicals around, we need to be careful that they're not on the surfaces of what we're using to collect the increments, store the samples, or to process the samples at the laboratory. So labs that have discrete sample PFAS capabilities have had to address those contamination concerns for discrete samples. And for those of them that have ISM capabilities, they've also typically applied those same contamination control measures for ISM samples as well. So it's just, you know, paying attention to, you know, carryover on surfaces, if it's, you know, high concentration to low concentration samples, or avoiding materials that actually might have PFAS either intentionally or accidentally applied to their surfaces. And obviously we don't want those in the sample processing.
Right, great. And I will note that recent ITRC does have an active PFAS team that is continuing with updates. And they have had an inquiry recently about ISM sampling for PFAS. So, all of our ITRC teams that are active are still taking memberships throughout the year. So if you have an interest, that's a great place to go. I also wanted to note, since we have a couple more questions about background, and we already answered some of those. The ITRC soil background and risk team recently published their document in December of 2021, and they have training that will be coming out here in the next 3 months. And I know that they have a full section on ISM as well. So another place that if you're looking for information on background, soil, and ISM, that is another resource that we encourage you to check out. Okay, let's see. Let's get back to some of our audience questions here. And they are constantly changing, so I apologize. So let's go with one that has been sitting here for a little bit. Since 1 kilogram of sample is collected, how does grinding play in getting a representative sample over the DU?
Okay, so that's a lab-related question, obviously. And milling or grinding, as some call it, is one of the ISM processing options that has been in use for nearly 20 years. It grows out of DOD efforts from the early 2000s, trying to get more reproducible data when explosives and energetics on some of the military fields. And in that case, the microscale heterogeneity is very extreme for either unburned bits of explosives, or it could be for metal fragments. And in that case, milling can be very beneficial to help do particle size reduction, mix those particles better into the bulk sample, so you end up with much more reproducible subsamples. Milling is not necessarily appropriate if the milling process is going to thermally degrade the analytes that you're looking for. And there are some temperature management processes that have been developed, particularly for explosives, but there are a lot of other organic analytes where we might consider doing milling. Historically, it hasn't been a primary tool, but there are a few instances where it might be applicable.
We do have questions going into the chat. I'll just remind folks, I am reading those. We are getting information, but if you have a specific question, please use the question and answer pod. But one of them here was, can ISM be used to estimate a background threshold value? For instance, a 95 UCLA on the 95th percentile?
Yeah, I think that might have already been addressed as part of one of the previous questions. But the short answer is it's not really appropriate to calculate a UTL from ISM results.
Great. And the person was already hypothesizing that the answer would be no. So always great to provide confirmation. All right, let's see where else. So Haley, since you were already just on and we touched very briefly on the UCL calculator, let's go back to a question we had earlier about when is it appropriate to use the UCL calculator versus a weighted UCL? And can you review how to use to obtain EPCs from each?
Yeah, so I think if you can go to that slide, I think it's slide 29, shows the UCL calculator. So basically, the calculator supports multiple different types of designs where you might lay out sampling units in different ways. And so I think the main assumption that you want to make sure is met when you use the UCL calculator versus doing a weighted UCL is that each of your sample results are equally representative of the area of the decision you want to make. So for example, if you have a sampling unit equivalent to a decision unit and you have multiple replicates within that, that's appropriate for this. Also, if you have one sample from different sampling units and together they represent a decision unit, that's also appropriate. And so the way you would do that is just enter those results in these green cells here. And then the UCL calculator will via Excel formulas, compute both a TUCL and a Chebyshev UCL, and it's going to recommend which one to use based on the ITRC guidance and simulations that we've done. Another alternative is using the weighted UCL. So if you want to skip ahead, I think a couple slides. I think one more. There we go. Okay. So a weighted UCL is going to be appropriate where you have different sampling units that are not equally representative of the area you're trying to make a decision about. So for this example, which is in section 6 of the document, you have a kindergarten playground and a playground for older children. And the kindergarten playground is only a quarter acre, and the other playground is a full acre. So, you know, you might have EPCs for each of those as separate decision units to represent each age group. But you might also have someone who spends time in both areas, like a maintenance worker or a teacher or something like that. And so you might decide, depending on the conceptual model, you might decide to weight them equally if the person spends both time in both areas, or you could weight them according to their area. And so the formulas for that are in the document and in section 6. So I won't go over those, but here's just a comparison of what you might get if you try to do a weighted UCL using either equal weights or proportionally to their area.
Great, thank you. I'm going to do an audience question here, and then we'll go revisit some older questions we have. With respect to the dilution concerns of ISM, the hotspot talking point is usually cited to support that ISM is still adequate. However, there is probably equal, if not more, concern about potential dilution at sites where borderline exceedances of cleanup benchmarks are anticipated. Could you please speak to these scenarios?
I don't know, Haley, do you want to take that? Want me to take it? I'm not really sure. Is the question that if you have a borderline ISM result, meaning close to the action level, that that might not be conservative enough to be protective? Is that what people think the question is or not?
Jason, that's how I interpreted the question.
Okay, so if that's the case, then the easy answer is you take replicates and you develop a 95th UCL statistically, and then that will address whatever concerns you have in terms of the confidence factor of a result that's close to an action level time. I think that's the easiest way I can put it.
Head's nodding, so.
Yeah, that's always a tough question. When you get close to a reporting limit, a screening level, whatever you want to call it, evaluating that data and looking at your confidence interval, and I'm not a statistician, so I'm speaking well out of my expert realm here, but when looking at your reproducibility of the data and your confidence interval, that's really the evidence you want. And in order to improve, lower that confidence interval around the UCL 95, you're going to probably want to plan on collecting more increments, more ISM samples for the same decision unit.
Yeah, I think one thing that's important there is, you know, looking at your data quality and making sure that you did have adequate data quality, especially if you're close to the action level. And then, of course, collecting more samples and making sure that you have an adequate number of samples. So you might want to pay attention to the power analysis section of the document, which is in section 3.3. So just making sure that you really did have enough samples to get an appropriate estimate of the EPC.
Great. We have one question here still outstanding. So Haley, I'm going to put this to you. Comment that it's been heard that EPA's pro-UCL is moving away from recommending the Chebyshev, I think is how you say it. How would this affect the ITRC 95 UCL calculator tool?
Yeah, that's a great question and kind of a tough question. The issue with the Chebyshev is that it's often extremely conservative. So if you have really skewed data, you could end up with a crazy UCL. And that's one of the reasons that the maximum value, substituting the maximum value is often used, because we might get a crazy UCL. But really, if you have such skewed data that the calculator recommends the Chebyshev UCL, that's really because there's really no other appropriate UCL unless you collected 8 or more samples. Your choices are basically the TUCL or the Chebyshev. And if the data are too skewed, that the TUCL is not appropriate, the Chebyshev is really your only option. But that being said, ISM results are supposed to be representative of the average. And so statistically, we expect the average to have a normal distribution. So if your data are so skewed that the calculator does recommend the Chebyshev, it can also be kind of a red flag that, well, maybe you didn't collect enough increments. Maybe you need to increase your number of increments in order to compensate for the high variability that you're seeing in the data. So I hope that answered the question.
No, that's great. Thank you. And so I wanted to take a moment with just our 4 minutes left to first thank the presenters for joining us today. We answered a lot of questions in the 1 hour, and really appreciate the attendees' commitment to this and putting the questions in. Here I'm showing the ISM2 guidance document if you've not had a chance to see the executive summary. If you scroll all the way down to the bottom, we do list our training resources, and one of those is an training Q&A digest that was populated and developed in October of 2021 as a result of all the questions that were fielded during session 1 and session 2. So another resource for you to take a look if you have any outstanding questions at this time. I'd encourage you to go into the Q&A digest and see what other questions have been answered by this expert panel. Additionally, you can view the session 1 and session 2 archives online here on the screen on the main page. They will get you there with additional information. And after this session today, this will be posted and archived as well as another tool in your toolbox to understand ISM. So with that, a huge thank you to our trainers for the time and effort. And it was great to see some faces after a year apart from the training team. They put a lot of time and effort into developing all of these resources for you guys. Don't forget to visit itrcweb.org for any additional information or guidance documents. You can find everything off of that main homepage. And with that, I'm going to close this expert panel session and just say thank you, and everybody have a wonderful rest of your day.